So this morning we finished the whole cycle of the various phases of the three modes of shamatha. And not really by design, but more by accident, today we'll finish the cycle of the four measurables. Obviously there can always be more and more variations, but for the time being, this will complete the cycle on equanimity. Tomorrow we'll go back to loving kindness, as tomorrow we'll also go back to the infirmary, the most basic way to practice mindfulness of breathing. As we come to return to, now for the last time, for the time being, the practice of equanimity. We can see this from two perspectives. One perspective, and the name I will choose is not pejorative, so it's not Hinayana as if somehow we're superior. Hinayana does have a pejorative connotation to it, so we don't need that. We can simply call it the Shravakayana. And a Shravakayana is one simply who is, a Shravaka is one who is intent on the realization of nirvana, to become an arhat, to be free. There's nothing wrong with that. And so Shravakayana, and then we have the Mahayana, for which the ideal is enlightenment, the enlightenment of a Buddha. From the Shravakayana perspective, and Theravada perspective is included in that, then the point of these four immeasurables is really to break down barriers, to dispel obstacles for one's practice of shamatha and vipassana, right? And it can be very, very helpful for that, to break down those barriers so that the shamatha and vipassana flow smoothly and you do achieve stream entry, once returner, non-returner, and then become an arhat. So it's really an aid to your own pursuit of your own individual liberation. And frankly, this is a noble pursuit to achieve liberation, and the four immeasurables are there. So for those following the shravaka path, there are some who devote a great deal of time and place a very great emphasis on the four immeasurables, others less so. They're not all the same, right? So there's one way of viewing these four immeasurables. Certainly these virtues are of intrinsic value. They don't need some outside justification. So they're not simply instruments for achieving something else. At the same time, the primary motivation for the shravaka is to achieve liberation. And these are very useful for that pursuit. So there's one perspective, and it's a noble and a worthy perspective. And then we come to the Mahayana perspective. And the four immeasurables there are all, they're almost like four roots feeding the primary stem or the trunk of bodhicitta, right? So there really is no bodhicitta without loving kindness, without compassion. Empathetic joy has to be part of the party. And then equanimity, for those of you like Anetsepel and many others here who've had so much teaching and actually experienced teaching yourselves, of the Mahayana, then you'll know is that the indispensable foundation, the indispensable basis or foundation for developing bodhicitta is equanimity. That is just uncontested. Without that, we're just back to, well, I like these people a lot, but those people not so much, and we're right back to attachment and aversion, right? So the equanimity is really the golden ground, just as ethics is the golden ground for Dharma altogether. Equanimity is the golden ground, the even golden ground for cultivating bodhicitta. On that basis of equanimity, then you cultivate great loving kindness, mahamaitri, which is beyond boundless loving kindness, great compassion, mahakaruna, which is beyond immeasurable compassion, even though the word wouldn't suggest that. You cultivate those two, and then you cultivate the extraordinary resolve, the laksam, the extraordinary resolve, right, to liberate all sentient beings from suffering and to bring each one to awakening, extraordinary resolve, and then out of that, then finally comes the bodhicitta itself. But we see there where these four immeasurables kind of culminate in the Shravakayana practice, coming to their crowning glory in equanimity. Right there where that culminates, right there is where you shift into second gear and the bodhicitta and the Mahayana really begins. With the root system, of course, of the four immeasurables. But there it begins there and takes off to the bodhicitta. So in both contexts, these are of tremendous value. And I'm sure that all of our Shamatha Project alumni here will attest that the four immeasurables are not only very conducive for developing vipassana, but also tremendous aids for developing shamatha and breaking down the obstacles in shamatha. So in all regards, very, very wonderful auxiliary practices or complementary practices to the shamatha. So I mentioned when I first introduced equanimity that this is not an anticlimax to the preceding three, but actually their full flowering. And what I'd like to do in this session is then to apply the Mahayana practice taught very, very clearly by Shantideva, taught in the seven-point mind training and others, the practice of Tonglen, of sending and receiving, sending and taking, and apply this to the practice of equanimity. Okay? So this would be then classic Mahayana practice, so we're then using this as a basis to really venture into, and on the one hand, to perfect this immeasurable, say, equanimity, but also to venture into the cultivation of the bodhicitta. So on this point, on Tonglen, there are various authentic ways of practicing it. It is not true that there's just one authentic means. There are multiple ones. It's quite clear from the great treatises, the great teachers of the past. There is one method in which, when you imagine taking on the sufferings of others and taking on the causes of suffering of others, the hatred, malice, ignorance, and so forth, you actually imagine taking this on and experiencing it yourself. Okay? And you imagine actually giving away all your virtue, your merit, and so forth. I would not suggest that for the time being. It's not that it's an inauthentic or incorrect practice. It does have its place. But where I would assume most of us are in our practice right now, I would suggest not taking that particular approach, but take the approach as I've taught it all along here, which I've also been taught. It's also one of the classic practices of visualizing, again, this innate purity of your own awareness, the deepest dimension, Rigpa, Buddha nature, symbolically visualizing or imagining this as an orb of light, in the heart chakra, and imagine that as you're drawing in darkness, that it's not taking it onto yourself like some disease or some great burden that makes you collapse under the weight, but rather you draw it in, but you siphon it in into the light at your heart, and you dissolve it there without trace. That's quite important. Okay? The classic teachings on this is that you imagine this darkness coming in and it disappearing as if you take a little feather of goose down and drop that in a fire. And when the lightest one that can almost float in the air, a little goose down, and imagine dropping that into a bonfire. You don't look for ash. You don't look for where did it go? It's gone, right? It's gone. And so likewise, when you draw in suffering and the cause of suffering, imagine that the coming in and then just being extinguished, utterly obliterated. And in fact, if you wanted to put a real Mahayana spin on this, you can use a metaphor from modern physics of matter and antimatter. And if you take a positron and an electron, so matter and antimatter, and you bring the two of them together, you probably know, bring them together, all the matter completely vanishes and it turns into pure energy. Okay? And so they played with that one in the novel Angels and Demons, where you bring matter, antimatter, and then poof, you get a big explosion, because the matter entirely turns into energy. So what you can do, that's just an analogy, of course, but when you draw in, let's say, the antimatter of suffering, the causes of suffering, and draw this into your heart, you can imagine your own self-grasping, self-centeredness, as colliding with the darkness from outside and the two extinguishing. That's actually another classic practice. You draw it in and the self-grasping annihilates just as the darkness from outside. So two types of darkness annihilate and all you have left is light. Okay? So if you do it in this practice of imagining the darkness coming in and extinguishing it without trace, just turning into pure energy or just dissolving into the light at your heart, there's really no downside. There's no danger here. Okay? And I like to play it safe. That is, when teaching meditation, not give people practices that might really do them damage, and then I have to say I'm sorry afterwards and try to fix the damage done. I like to go more safe route, so I don't need to either apologize or try to undo the trouble that I've made for you. Okay? So this is a very safe approach to Tonglen, but it's also authentic. It's not just for, how do you say, wimpy people. Okay. So, I think that's enough for now. Let's go to the practice. One session, equanimity. So always begin by settling the body in its natural state. As soon as you bring your awareness into the body, you may already, by association, feel a softening of the muscles in the shoulders, a softening of the face, a settling of your body in a state of ease and comfort. Settle your body in its natural state. And settle your respiration in its natural flow, effortless, unimpeded. And throughout the course of the session, now and again check up to see that the meditation itself is not constraining the breath. You're not holding the breath or inhibiting it in any way. All through the session, let your breath flow as effortlessly as if you were deep asleep. And for a little while, settle your mind in its natural state, at ease, still, and clear, by way of mindfulness of breathing. Do not visualize the body. There's nothing to think about. Just be aware of the sensations of the breath in any of the three modes that you choose, full body, rise and fall of the abdomen, or the apertures of the nostrils. And now let's move from this more passive mode of awareness to a more active, creative, imaginative mode. Knowing that this stage, the arena of the mind, is our own substrate, our own private cinema. Knowing too that it's the same cinema, the same space of the mind in which dreams arise. in which we seem to be appearing and encountering a wide variety of people, whereas in fact we're not encountering any other person at all, only appearances to our own minds. Those people are hollow, they're empty, they are only appearances, there is no subject there, as we dream of people. They are only appearances, and they are appearances of our own minds. Similarly, now in the waking state, in this private cinema of your own mind, instead of imagining yourself as in a dream, taking on the forms of other people, have a private viewing now of yourself in three modes. First of all, play a movie. Draw from your memory of yourself. Some occasion in the past where how you appeared to yourself was as a person you really didn't like, and maybe for very good reason, in terms of motive behavior, the type of mental afflictions dominating your mind, but as an object, as an appearance, here is a basis for not liking yourself, perhaps something stronger, self-contempt, self-loathing. Bring to mind in the cinema of your own awareness, the space of your mind, an occasion where you felt very little sympathy with yourself, but rather more just dislike, maybe even disgust. What got into me? And bring this disagreeable person to mind as vividly as possible, and the reasons why you feel disgust on this occasion towards yourself. It's especially on such occasions when our minds are dominated by mental afflictions that we are most worthy of compassion. It is when our minds are most afflicted, as if we were physically afflicted, but now it's mental. The mind has become toxic and we're suffering. And out of our delusion and out of suffering, we behave in sometimes very regrettable ways. As you attend to yourself on one of those regrettable instances, look upon yourself with compassion. And with each in-breath, arouse the yearning. May this person, may I, be free of suffering and the causes of suffering, including mental afflictions, modes of behavior. With each in-breath, imagine drawing in the darkness of suffering and its causes, breathing it in with the aspiration of compassion, and dissolve this darkness into the inexhaustible orb of light at your heart and extinguish it there without trace. May I be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. Each in-breath, imagine becoming free. Imagine this burden dissolving away. Allow this memory to fade, dissolve back into the space of the mind. And now bring to mind another manifestation, another memory, where you're really quite happy with yourself. You like yourself. Your physical appearance, your voice, your way of speaking, your attitude. You appear to yourself as a very admirable person, very likable, maybe even quite exceptional. Here, virtues of the mind dominate and manifest in behavior. Very likable. Even to the point that we may exaggerate our good qualities. But this person too, just like yourself, on the most miserable of occasions, is always seeking for happiness, is wishing simply to be free of suffering. As you attend to yourself in this more positive light, breathe out. Breathe out the aspiration of loving kindness. May you find not only hedonic well-being, mundane happiness, but may you find genuine happiness and cultivate the causes of such genuine well-being. May your heart's desire be fulfilled, and with each out-breath, breathe out this light of loving kindness. And imagine filling your whole being, wishing yourself well, and imagine finding the happiness that is your heart's desire. And allow that memory to fade, that conceptual artifact to dissolve back into the space of the mind. And now bring to mind a self-image, a phase of your life, a memory in which you feel just ordinary. Your sense of yourself arouses neither aversion nor attachment, neither humiliation nor pride. Well, you just seem ordinary. Ordinary or not, the yearning for happiness, the wish to be free of suffering is always there, and the worthiness of being free and of finding happiness, this too is there. As you attend to yourself, bring in the full practice of Donglen. With the in-breath, arouse the yearning, may I be free of suffering and the true causes of suffering. And imagine dissolving this darkness into your heart. And with the out-breath, arouse the yearning of loving-kindness, may I be truly well and happy. May I cultivate the causes of such well-being. And from breath to breath, imagine this to be so. Imagine finding freedom and finding fulfillment. And now within the same domain of your own mind, bring to mind a person who does appear disagreeable to you. And again, maybe for very good reasons, maybe has treated you deplorably, maybe manifests very strong, toxic mental afflictions, is really a disagreeable person. Perhaps not only to you, perhaps to many people. Bring the appearance vividly to mind. Bring your narrative, the stories you tell about this person, to yourself. Bring the appearances vividly to mind. We cultivate compassion not towards appearances, not towards mental constructs or towards narratives. They're not people. They're just mental formations. Look beyond with your mind's eye to the person who is out there independently of our stories, of our experience, of our memories, of our likes and dislikes. Attend to the person. Attend to the depth of this person where you feel this person is like me. Fundamentally, essentially like me. From day to day, trying to find happiness. Wishing to be free of pain and suffering. Attend to this reality. By way of images, attend to the reality beyond the images, to the person, him or herself. Your brother, your sister, your fellow sentient being, and with each in-breath, arouse the yearning. May you, like myself, be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And practice as before. With each in-breath, imagine this person finding relief, finding freedom, finding peace. Allow the appearances to dissolve back into the space of the mind and bring to mind vividly a person whose very appearance arouses a sense of pleasure, admiration, affection, and attachment. The real person doesn't always appear attractive, not always pleasant. It's a person. Once again, look through the pleasant veil. To the person like yourself, who most likely does experience mental afflictions, has hopes and fears, joys and sorrows, just like yourself, is wishing for happiness. Freedom from suffering. And however your relationship with this person has changed in the past and will undoubtedly change in the future, with each out-breath, arouse the aspiration of loving kindness. May you always find happiness. May you always cultivate the causes of happiness. May you be well. Breathe out the light of loving kindness. utterly expand the space of your awareness. In all directions. And simply embrace all those around you, human and non-human alike, most of them strangers, but the strangers become friends, the strangers become enemies, all in a state of flux. But we all seek happiness and wish to avoid pain. With each out-breath, send out the light of loving kindness to all beings in all directions. May each one, like myself, be well and happy. And with each in-breath, draw in and extinguish the darkness of suffering and its causes. As you arouse the aspiration, may each one, like myself, be free. Then dissolve of all appearances and release all objects of the mind, all aspirations, and for a moment rest, letting your awareness rest in its own place. Let's bring the session to a close. Oh, Lasso. I thought maybe what we can do tonight is actually, tonight I have no footnotes, no package to deliver. I just have questions to respond to. But I thought to keep this kind of more engaged, it would be nice, frankly, if we can kind of move out of the written questions and really just have ongoing dialogue here. Makes it more lively, more here and now. At the same time, I do understand that some people are shy And some people really just want to formulate their question quite clearly with a lot of thought and find it better to write down. So I thought for the format this afternoon, what I thought might be good as an experiment would be for me to read one, respond to it, and then open up to hand coming up and respond to an actual person. Okay? Go back and forth, see if we can get through these. So I'll start with a written one. Aha. Here, finally, you've been waiting for this for days. Can I actually give a short answer? That is the question. I think if we had a little betting pool on the, you know, going back in the back room, I think the odds would be, forget it. The guy cannot give a short answer. Totally impossible. I'm about to prove you wrong. In the Hinayana, or let's use the word Shravakayana, practitioner's perspective, one could say Theravada. That's not pejorative at all. Is becoming an arhat, is this the same as becoming a Buddha? No. I could add commentary to that, but then I'd lose my bet, right? So, no, Buddha's higher. Arhats, not as high a realization. Arhats are all equally free of mental afflictions, but arhats vary a lot in terms of the virtues. So some have much greater paramonal abilities, some greater compassion, some greater wisdom. Among Buddhas, there's no difference. There's no more compassionate Buddha, less compassionate Buddha. They all are, in Tibetan, Changchup or Sangye, completely dispelled, all obscurations, completely brought to fulfillment, all virtues. So that was pretty short. Yes, okay, you want, we're going to have a... In fact, but what I'd like to do... No, is it a follow-up on that one?
Yeah.
Okay, then carry on.
Do I need the mic?
Yes, let's have the mic. And was that question by you, anybody? No, it was by Alejandra. I think it was by Alejandra. From... there's that one. I think it was from... Yes, may I say the name?
Sure.
The question? Where are you? There's Alejandra. Yes, that was Alejandra's question. Very good. Yes, Noah,
just,
a follow-up.
Did the question, just to clarify, did it say according to the Theravada, do they believe that a Buddha is higher than an arhat?
Yes.
And
no
so
question
you're saying
about it.
They even say that the Buddha is higher than the arhat.
Yes, they do. Okay. They do. And they would say, well, what's the difference? They would say in the Theravada, they would say, is the Buddha an arhat? Yes. But the Buddha is an exceptional arhat because of a vastly greater accumulation of punya, of merit. And so spent a much, much longer time to become a Buddha than to become an arhat, right? And therefore the Buddha has exceptional abilities across the board that none of his arhat disciples had matched, right? So that's very, very clear there. At the same time, from the Theravada perspective, the widespread belief is that at any one point, at least for this world here, at any one point in a whole phase of history, an era of history, there's only one person on the planet who is now a bodhisattva destined to become the next Buddha, a Buddha. Right now it's Maitreya, or Maitreya in Pali. There's one bodhisattva here, Maitreya, right? And he will become Buddha. But so overall in the Theravada tradition, it's not considered to be a realistic goal. It's for the extremely exceptional few, and they have that special responsibility, burden, and very, very long path. What is practical? What's accessible? What's realistic? Become an arhat. That's it. So overall, there are exceptions here and there, but by and large, that's the view. And they do unequivocally say that the virtues of a Buddha, the scope of wisdom, the scope of his powers, the scope of his compassion, and so forth, are beyond those of arhats. Yeah, that's not a Mahayana superimposition. That's from the Theravada, from its own side. Yeah, so it's not a sectarian business. Yeah. Okay, so that I guess that was the follow-up. So let's do another question here. Very glad, Ilse. This is not a question, but I'm very glad that Ilse. We have no sound report. Thanks to I think Daniel. So thank you for your wonderful help. And now some doozies. Oy oy oy. Okay. Okay, so can you say a bit more about instructions of gazing up, right, left, and so forth this morning, that is a couple of mornings, in the awareness of awareness practice? It felt to me as intensifying the non-location aspect with a wider opening. So I referred to that briefly this morning, and may I say who asked the question?
Yeah.
or would you like to be anonymous? This is in three different parts. Or would you like to be anonymous? If I don't hear anybody, I'll assume you want it to be anonymous. Yeah, it's Adelina. It's Adelina. Perfectly good question. Yeah, I think you have it right, that the reason for directing the gaze up and down is exactly what you intuitively found, and that is the non-locality. That is, awareness doesn't have a center. It doesn't have borders. It's not up here. It's not down. And so by directing upwards, it disengages from the sense of boundariness, okay? And opens up the spacious aspect, the non-location aspect. And fundamentally, just a rule of thumb here, especially in the Mahayana, the Vajrayana Dzogchen, is that there's an indivisibility between space and awareness. That is, not physical space is something absolutely independent, but space and awareness are commingling, they are coextensive. Okay? So substrate consciousness and substrate on the conventional level. But if we go to the ultimate level, Dhamma Dhatu and primordial consciousness, absolutely indivisible. So I think this opens that up again in a very practical way. Part two, connecting to earlier questions by Anna, and my responses about the fact that in rare cases, shamatha practice of any kind, shamatha practice of any kind may yield insight into emptiness or pristine awareness. Oh, not true. Not true, not any kind. And so if one is doing a classic Mahayana practice, in fact, most shamatha practices are not likely at all to lead to insight into emptiness or pristine awareness. Most are not. In the Theravada tradition, for example, there are meditations on the kasinas, focusing on an earth element, emblem, the earth kasina, water, fire, and so forth. The chances of that giving rise to insight into Vipassana-style insight, I don't think it even comes up. It's not likely. It wasn't designed to do that. And likewise in the Mahayana tradition, if you're focusing on a Buddha image, is that going to give rise to insight into the emptiness of a Buddha? Not likely. Why would it? Is that going to, as you're focusing on the Buddha image and it becomes more and more stable, more and more clear, will that give insight into the innate mind of clear light, the Nyukme Sen or Rigpa? No, why would it? So most methods of shamatha are just straight 100% shamatha, right? Among the wide variety, two are highlighted, and that is settling the mind in its natural state, or Semlemi Pishine in Tibetan. Then this practice can very clearly, number one, this clearly will give insight into the conventional or relative nature of the mind. So you actually know the nature of consciousness. As I know the color red, as I know the smell of peaches, I know it. There's no doubt about it. I can recognize the smell of peaches. You know the nature of consciousness. You don't have to write books about it. You don't have to defend it. You just know it because you have seen it directly. But in the practice of settling the mind in its natural state, this also, because of its close proximity to the Vipassana practice of Citta Satipatthana or Sem Tempanyewa Shapa, which is a Vipassana practice, Hlaktong, this can give rise, really, definitely can give rise to insight into the three marks of existence of impermanence, suffering, and non-self. Now those are Vipassana-style insights. It's possible. You might even gain You might actually gain realization of the empty nature, the lack of inherent nature of these thoughts, images, and so forth. So that practice, settling the mind, that's on the cusp between shamatha and vipassana. I've never seen any mention, though, that that practice would give rise to insight into rigpa. Maybe, but I've never heard it, so I don't say it, right? Whereas when it comes to awareness of awareness, and note the specific method, because out of those four phases, he is referring to one sub-method in particular, where you're drawing your awareness right in upon that which is aware, that which is the agent, that which is the agent. Could this practice, it's still a shamatha practice. Why? Because it gives rise to relaxation, stability, and vividness, and dissolves your mind into the substrate consciousness, and you achieve shamatha. So, if it does the work of shamatha, then we call it shamatha. But because there is an element of inquiry there, which is the primary characteristic of vipassana. Vipassana is not just a placing of attention, jokom, but entails some investigation, some inquiry, jekom. Because it is inquiry, probe into and examine the nature of that which is aware, that which is controlling, releasing, and withdrawing the attention. Even though it's shamatha, there's an element of inquiry. Could that give insight into the empty nature of the self, the observer? It could. Could you can actually break through the reification, dambarisimba, reification, that the reification of your own mind, could you break through that, seeing through the empty nature of the mind and penetrate right through to rikpa, or the innate mind of clear light? Well, my opinion doesn't matter. Who am I? I have no authority. But Padmasambhava said, that method right there of probing right in upon the nature of that which is aware, he said, it is possible. You may identify rikpa. Rikpa ngotupa, it's called in Tibetan. Rikpa ngotupa, which is the point of tekchur, the breakthrough practice. So this is what he states. And number one, of course, I believe it. But I've also had other instructions in Dzogchen. Specifically, I had marvelous instructions a few years back by a truly accomplished Dzogchen master who had achieved shamatha and vipassana. He was really accomplished. He's still alive. Yang Tanrinpoche. He's going to be teaching in California this fall. And so I received teachings on Dzogchen from him. And drawing from this text, the flight of the Garuda on that text, when teaching Dzogchen itself, it looked very similar to this practice of probing right in upon the nature of that which is aware. And yet it wasn't called shamatha, it was called Dzogchen. So we see that practice. Is it shamatha? Yeah, Padmasambhava called it shamatha, he should know. But in this other classic Dzogchen text, something very similar, but within the Dzogchen view, and that's the big difference. You can practice the awareness of awareness, awareness without sign, sema mebishine. You can practice that without a Buddhist view. You don't have to be Buddhist. Without the view of emptiness, of course, you don't need that. You can practice it without Dzogchen view. You can be a Hindu, you can be a Christian. You can be a person not religious. If you keep very pure ethics and you do the practice correctly, why not? You look at what are the necessary ingredients, the necessary causes, the outer and inner causes. Not one of them was, oh, you have to be Buddhist. You have to have contentment, few desires, very good ethics. You must stem the flow of the namdo, or of the compulsive thinking. So there are these, and then you must lead a lifestyle with karasa, dunyung, janyung, very few concerns and very few activities. The lifestyle while achieving shamatha. Those are the internal. There wasn't one that said, oh, and it's very good to have companions, but that's part of the environment. And then there's the conducive environment. But not once did it say, oh, to achieve shamatha, you have to take refuge in Buddha. You have to believe in reincarnation. You have to believe this, that. Don't. So you can practice shamatha and simply achieve shamatha, right? And gain insight into conventional nature of the mind. But when this same practice of probing right in upon the nature of that which is aware, when that's done within the context of the view and the way of life of Dzogchen, then now we're in the midst of a triad. In Tibetan, ta, gong, chö. When you do that same practice within the context of the Dzogchen view, then you're doing this as the meditation. And you're supporting this with a way of life in accordance with the teachings of Dzogchen, the great perfection. Then that's a Dzogchen practice. Okay? So it's context. Context is everything. We need the microphone. We're here to Adelina.
Yes, actually, thank you very much for this response. In my question, there is part of it is when awareness of awareness practice gives this falling through, the breakthrough. Even
okay,
when
that happens,
shamatha,
okay. If
practice,
it happens, yes.
Yeah. So
yes.
How does that relate to the sequence that you named? Shamatha, vipassana, breaking through, crossing.
Acha, okay, understood.
Complete.
Understood,
because
yeah.
The jump.
I understand.
It's jumping over the vipassana. Is that coming later?
No, it's not. It's not jumping over either. No. It's not jumping over. And that's because normally, in almost all cases, when you're practicing shamatha, in Tibetan you call this, the type of meditation is called jokkom. It is simply a placing of the awareness on the meditative object. And that includes settling the mind. You're simply placing the mind in the space of the mind, placing the mind to whatever arises within that space. But you're not investigating. You're not posing questions. It is just that. Likewise, if you focus on a Buddha image, likewise, if you focus on the breath, there's no investigation, there's no question. In this practice, Padmasambhava says, occasionally ask, what is the nature of that which is meditating? What is the nature of that which is releasing and contracting? That's a question. And that is what Vipassana does. So it's a Vipassana-style question. It's very simple. It's a very simple. And there are much more elaborate ways to engage investigation in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddhist discourse on the four applications of mindfulness, Do Tema Nyewa Shakpa. It's much more elaborate. It's beautiful. It's majestic. You go to the writings of Nagarjuna and Sawasherap, his Mula Madhyama Karika, his great classic treatise on the middle way view, multiple reasonings, multiple investigations. So this practice of just probing in and asking the question, what is the nature of that which is the agent, the observer, the controller? It's a Vipassana-style question, and for those who are very ripe, or another way of phrasing it, for those of very sharp faculties, who are really mature, from a Buddhist perspective, have done a lot of practice in the last life, or maybe a lot of practice in this lifetime, but they're really very mature, very ripe. That simple question alone may suffice, not only for shamatha, it's a shamatha practice, that question and the probing suffices as vipassana. Breaks through to the emptiness of the mind, and then slips right on through. So if with that one simple strategy, you're practicing shamatha vipassana and making the breakthrough into rikpa, what you're not doing is the tutgel, the direct crossing over in which you bring forth the full qualities of the enlightened mind. Okay?
Yes. So this, what you say, this simple question about the nature of awareness that gives the insight, the insights as are otherwise required in Vipassana about impermanence.
That's right. That's right.
Suffering, non-self, the whole larger picture.
Exactly right. And we find reflections of this all through the Buddhist tradition. One of the earliest and most classic is in the case of the wanderer, the Shramana Bahiya, who was clearly a very mature soul. He was an accomplished yogi. He must have had tremendous samadhi already. He had 500 disciples. He was an accomplished yogi and meditation master. And he recognized that he had not achieved liberation. He had that self-honesty. He could have been so proud, and I'm big yogi, but no, he was so honest. He saw that, yeah, he's got a lot of disciples and he's probably very fine samadhi, had not achieved liberation. He sought out the Buddha. The Buddha gave him about one paragraph, maybe two paragraphs, of really short Dharma talk, shorter than most of my answers. So he gives him two paragraphs, and Bahi became an arhat right there. He said, wait a minute, he should have become a stream enterer, and then a once-returner, then a non-returner, then arhat. Yeah, he did. In one, by the end of the Dharma talk, he was an arhat. So it can happen sometimes, very short, very quintessential teachings, especially when taught by a Buddha to someone who is extremely ripe. Everything is condensed, it's collapsed in. Okay? On many other occasions, the Buddha would give very simple teachings. The person would immediately achieve stream entry, not arhat, but would have direct realization of nirvana and achieve stream entry, path of seeing, you know. And some people have read that, reading this, and say, ah, you see, shamatha is not necessary. What they're missing is the whole context. Is that doesn't happen to most people. But what the Buddha was doing, this is somebody who had the merit, the karma, to meet and receive teaching from the Buddha himself. Just consider, that is incredibly, incredibly rare karma. To have that, who's your teacher? Oh, Buddha Shakyamuni. Oh, good for you. You know, this is really rare. We don't have that karma. You know, nobody's had that karma for 2,500 years. And so the amount of merit you would have to be to have one-on-one instruction by the Buddha to you beyond comprehension. So when the Buddha would sometimes give very short teachings and then the person would right there achieve stream entry, it's most reasonable to assume is the Buddha was going, blowing off a little bit of dust, the previous realization of dhyana, of shamatha, was just blown away, And right there, the shamatha came up spontaneously, and there was the teachings of insight, the fusion of shamatha vipassana took place instantaneously. Right? I think that's the most reasonable, rather than thinking, oh, well, you see, shamatha is not necessary after all. You know, I don't think that's a realistic understanding. Because normally, vipassana doesn't arise just by giving a teaching, you know, one little paragraph either. So, and we recall there's a precedent for that, and that is the Gautama as a youth, just sitting under the rose apple tree, and out comes the first jhana. He wasn't even trying, he was just sitting there with his senses secluded and so forth. And so on those occasions where a person is receiving direct teachings from the Buddha, we can assume there's an enormous amount of energy coming in there already, and hence people gain this very, very rapid realization. So final question. How about breakthrough via a way of very refined settling the mind in its natural state? As I said, I've never seen it. It may be true, I don't know. What is stated very explicitly is that the settling the mind can lead to the insights of the four applications of mindfulness. That Dzogchen Lingpa states. And I think with very good reason, and that's not mysterious. Less happening as there may be less melting of the substrate. On the other hand, there have come up many insights in the relative mind, as in impermanent suffering, non-self, in a way that some vipassana aspects of insight reality have already been fully addressed. Yeah. So once again, just to reiterate that point, maybe it's conceivable, maybe it's happened to someone, but I've just never heard of it. But insights into these three marks of existence, yes, definitely. Okay. A question from somebody alive. You're welcome, Adilina. Somebody alive here and now. Yes, Elizabeth, please. I guess you're all alive here and now, but now we just have direct voice.
This one actually follows on in a way.
Jolly good.
Did you hear?
Jolly good.
Oh.
Jolly good old chap.
The sense of bringing the awareness in.
Yes.
And opening it out.
Yes.
In my experience, my awareness doesn't seem to move.
Does not move, uh-huh.
So what I sort of just do it by asking the question.
Mm-hmm.
Who's meditating or mm-hmm. what's the mind? And then when I try to do the other one, I say, well, what's space? But mm-hmm. I still don't get the sense of anything moving.
Good, good. It's not so much a matter of moving, like as if your attention is a train on a monorail, and it goes out, and then it goes back in again. Not like that, okay? But rather, I think if we have an image, and I'm suggesting this image only as a leap-off to the meditation, not to drag the image into the meditation, because then we're just meditating on mental constructs. But more, I'm certain you've seen jellyfish that go, or just a balloon blowing up and inflating. So you can say, but the balloon's not moving. The balloon's not going anyplace, and it's true. The balloon's here, just getting bigger and smaller, bigger and contracting, but it's not going over there and going over here and like that. So as an image, it's just an image, and it's not the real thing. It's a model or an image. It's more of the sense of just release. Just a sheer sense of spaciousness, of just release is the best word. Expansive, but I just come back to the word release. In samadhi, samadha, the very connotation of samadhi is a coalescence, a gathering, a collectedness, a unification. And so that is the nature. That is the nature of samadhi. That is, it's a focusing, it's a gathering, a unification of awareness in contrast to being fragmented, dispersed, and so on. And so when we're coming right into the very nature of awareness, as in this, let your awareness come in now and just be aware of the awareness itself, as in this first phase and the last phase of those four phases. Okay? The first phase, rest your awareness evenly in space and now concentrate and now release. Concentrate and release. Almost verbatim what Padmasambhava said. Concentrate, well, does that mean coming in? No, it doesn't mean coming in. It just means an intensification of the awareness contracting in upon itself, not moving here or there, but just a withdrawal from all appearances. That's really what it is. It's a withdrawal from all appearances, just in the very nucleus, into the very nature of being aware itself. And then the release is not going off someplace, it's just just that sense of release, of expansiveness. I think the word release just captures it. Not going anywhere, it's just, ah. But the ah, the release, is not spacing out. It's not going, ah, like that. It's the release, but it's still gently sustaining. And I like the image of holding a thread between two fingers. That you don't have to, it's a thread. You know, it's not a 20-pound weight. So it's a thread, so you just hold it very delicately. But you do sustain it all the way through. You don't go, ha, and then just lose everything. So even when you're releasing, you're very gently sustaining the thread, sustaining the flow of awareness of awareness. Okay? So use this as a model to begin with of the kind of like, and then release the model when you're actually doing the practice. And just do it. Just concentrate, draw the awareness right in upon being aware. And what that means is, where's in? Is it in here, here, here? Where's in? In is away from all appearances. Appearances are out. Whether it's an appearance of something inside your head, inside your mind, over here, over there, over there, appearances are out. Withdrawing from all appearances is in. So it doesn't have a location. It's not in here, here, here. It's just you're losing all interest in all appearances, all objects to the mind, drawing awareness right in upon the awareness of awareness with no interest in anything else. And then, and it's now not that you're taking an interest in appearances, you're just releasing. Is that clear?
Yeah. But the eyes.
The eyes?
When I was trying to do this, one of the things that seemed to happen was that my eyes tried to look inside out.
The mind what?
I tried to turn my eyes inside out.
You're trying to get the eyes to go inside out? That won't work.
Not literally, figuratively.
It works in cartoons. But otherwise it doesn't work.
No, I mean figuratively to look. But I think also I find the awareness gets very stuck to the eyes. Because when you did this look, and then you said do 360 degrees.
Uh-huh.
To get 360 degrees, I had to shut my eyes.
Ah, and that's, you don't need to. You don't need to. Because it's not an exercise of visual perception. There's that one brief interlude. There's that one brief interlude where you are literally directing your visual gaze up. This is an exercise that's almost like stretching in the morning. You don't do that all day. But that's kind of like, okay, like that. So it's stretching upwards, stretching to the right, to the left, and down. Just again, as Adelina correctly surmised, and Anna has also, it just does, by that brief exercise, it's very transitional, but it does have that sense of expansiveness, of opening, kind of loosening up, getting more spacious. But apart from that, where you clearly are directing your attention up, but it's not really a matter of, in fact, quite explicitly, it's not a matter of, what's up there? Whoa, ceiling. Oh, I must be craning the head. Whoa, ceiling. You know? It's not looking up there with the eyeballs and saying, how high can I raise my eyebrows so I can really see up there? You know? It's not a visual practice. And so quite explicitly, Padmasambhava says, direct your gaze up without looking at anything, without taking anything as an object. In other words, you're still doing the practice. Even though the eyes are going up, you're not actually directing your mental awareness up there. You're not tracking. You're not tracking mental awareness to visual awareness. The eyes are going up, and what are you doing with your mind? Taking nothing as an object, which means you are sustaining awareness of awareness. Okay? So, yet, don't get these two locked in, just as it's very imperative not to track your visual perception with your mental awareness when you're focusing here. Unless you really do want to walk up, hello, my name's Elizabeth. Unless you want to develop a long habit of being cross-eyed, you know. Well, I've been practicing mindfulness breathing a long time now. And so, yeah, disengage. Disengage the visual, both for mindfulness of breathing as well as there, and for that matter, of course, settling the mind in its natural state too. Yes, they say have the eyes open, and the very next word is, let the gaze be vacant. So as a little metaphor, it's one that works for me, is I'm sure you've done this countless times. You've driven your car into one of those big parking lots, and then you close the door, you go beep beep, or you lock it one way or another. You lock your car, And then you walk away. And you're not thinking about the car anymore. You beep, beep, locked, secure, taken care of, and you go off and do your shopping. So you parked it, and then you just leave it. In a similar fashion, you're parking your visual gaze in the parking lot of the space in front of you. Beep, beep, walk away. And you're directing your mental awareness now to the space of the mind, which is not the visual space at all. And likewise, when you're practicing awareness of awareness, you're just attending to awareness. You're not looking at the visual field. Okay? Good. Okay, we have another one here. So, just some clarification about the practice. You can mention my name. So this is from Malcolm. So say again? I thought so as well. So good, we don't need to deal with that one now because it was addressed. In fact, I had seen it before, so I tried to weave in it a little bit. So jolly good. That takes care of all of our written questions. And lo and behold, 15 minutes left. Anything else coming up? On anything, bear in mind, four immeasurables as well. Yes, back to Nathan, way back in the corner. Thank you, Elizabeth. Nathan, way over yonder. Get all these young men to help you. Really good.
My question is, are Buddhas exactly the same as Bodhisattvas? And if so, why don't they just say Buddha instead of Bodhisattva? Are they exactly the same, is my question.
Very good. The question is, everybody heard because you have a microphone. Nope, there is no one who is a Buddhist, who is a bodhisattva and who is a Buddha. Just like there is no one who is a kangaroo and a daffodil. You can't be both. Gawade. So they're mutually exclusive. If you're a Buddha, you're not a bodhisattva. If you're a bodhisattva, you're not a Buddha. So what's the difference? I've used a couple of terms here, and one of these is bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is one of the most cherished words in the whole Mahayana tradition. It literally means awakening mind, awakened mind, mind of enlightenment. But what bodhicitta is an aspiration. It is the ideal, the aspiration of a bodhisattva. And what that is very simply stated is, it is the aspiration to achieve perfect awakening, but it's an altruistic aspiration. It's not just be all that you can be. I want to be the greatest. But out of altruism, out of loving kindness and compassion, wishing to realize the highest possible state of spiritual awakening, in order to be of greatest possible service to others, to liberate sentient beings from suffering, to bring other sentient beings to liberation, to enlightenment themselves. So to my mind, this bodhicitta, so I'll just stick with the Sanskrit, the bodhicitta to my mind, now my opinion, it takes the two noblest aspirations that a person can have, a human being can have. Obviously, I'm giving you a big opinion here, so just an opinion. But it is my opinion, and that is, here's one aspiration, and I call it kind of the vertical aspiration, that whatever the potential that there is of this sentient being here, potential for virtue, for wisdom, for compassion, for genuine happiness, for freedom, whatever potential there is for a spiritual awakening, liberation, nirvana, Buddhahood, may that be realized. To my mind, that is an enormously noble aspiration, you know, to achieve awakening, perfect awakening, whatever that may be, the highest possible. There's one aspiration, and I would say that's a vertical aspiration. And that would, with that aspiration, one can easily imagine, a person driven by that motivation, or moved by that motivation, going off into living in a cave for 20, 30, 40 years, and saying, I want to radically simplify everything else. I'll eat one little cup full of barley flour each day with some butter in it, and that's it, and I'm just going absolutely for the vertical, right? And there are yogis who've done that. There's also, though, another, I would say, equally noble aspiration, and that is the aspiration to be of service, with the awareness of the enormity, the magnitude, the depth of suffering in the world, and the ways, really tragically, that we human beings, for example, perpetuate our own suffering, you know, way beyond what is dished out to us by hurricanes and earthquakes and tsunamis and fires and droughts and disease and so forth, as if that's not enough. You know, and that's pretty intense already, just the suffering from natural calamities. But then we have civil wars, and we have ethnic cleansing, we have child abuse, and we have genocide, and we have religious fanaticism, and we have greed and exploitation, and these things where it's as if somehow under this delusional fit, we got together and say, you know, I think nature's not delivering enough suffering. Why don't we just massively compound it with suffering that we create for ourselves? And we all say, yeah, put her there, put her there. We all get 7 billion of us get together, good idea. Let's make much more suffering than nature can deliver to us. You know, like some kind of a hysterical fit. And so just recognizing how much suffering there is, some from natural calamities. Nobody was to blame for the suffering in Haiti with the earthquake there. Or, you know, now it's a tornado, about 1.5 kilometers in diameter. Tornado, 1.5 kilometers in diameter, swept through part of the South. Mississippi killed a number of people, wiped out whole areas, just obliterated them. Must have been a class 5 tornado. Well, nobody's responsible for that. So they're suffering from natural calamities, suffering from aging, sickness, and death, and then all the suffering we compound on top of that. So the more horizontal aspiration is just with this open heart, feeling the empathy, the sympathy, with the magnitude of suffering of sentient beings, and just wishing, may I help. May I help as much as I possibly can. May I alleviate as much suffering as I can. And it's not only bringing people back up to just breathing a sigh of relief, but then having some sense we really have extraordinary capacity for finding happiness. Not just being okay, but actually to tap into the inner wellsprings of the depths of what it means to be a sentient being, and wishing, might I bring each one to their fulfillment, you know? And so this extraordinary altruism, operating out of compassion to bring people out of suffering, and then out of loving kindness to bring them to their own fulfillment. And again, this is not religious zealotry. It's not like, let's get everybody to be Buddhist. I want everybody to know what my ideal is so they can realize my ideal. It's none of that kind of stuff. It's really helping every person realize their own heart's desire, right? So that altruism that moves how many people, I don't need to give you names, but people have devoted their lives selflessly, majestically, wondrously, to really being of tremendous service to those around them. Some of them get big prizes, like a Nobel Peace Prize, others working quietly, but just such altruism. And imagine that just being expanded so no one is included in the scope of one's compassion and loving kindness. So there's the horizontal plane, so to speak. And so then we have this altruism, the wish to alleviate suffering, to bring others to happiness. We have the aspiration oneself on this vertical axis to achieve the highest possible state of enlightenment, spiritual awakening, liberation. And then, so I would say these are the two noblest aspirations. That's my opinion. But now we fuse these into one. We fuse them into one, and that is bodhicitta, where that aspiration of the vertical plane is there, but what's the motivation? It is in order to be of greatest possible service horizontally, in order to be of greatest possible service, no matter who I meet, for however long it may take, in order to be of greatest service, the way to be effective is to achieve the highest possible state of enlightenment. That's where the greatest wisdom will be, the greatest compassion, the greatest creativity, and so forth. And so therefore, this is summarized in this very simple phrase, may I achieve perfect awakening for the sake of all sentient beings. So that's bodhicitta, that is the mind of a bodhisattva. And when that aspiration arises after, in most cases, a lot of cultivation, one meditates on it, cultivates it, practices donglen, and all of that, when that arises to the point that it just emerges spontaneously. It flows just naturally, like breathing out, breathing in. Like wanting to go for food when you're hungry. You don't have to think, now I have to generate the desire, you know, it just happens. When it arises spontaneously, where it is your heart's desire, it is your desire of desires, your prime directive, such that all of your other desires are derivative of that. And it's spontaneous, it's effortless. It's really what your fundamental yearning and aspiration is. From that point, then you're a bodhisattva. And so you are a Buddha in the making. You're a Buddha in the making. You've entered the Buddha family. Okay? And so then, with that aspiration, it comes in two modes. One is simply the aspiration itself, cultivating that so that it arises spontaneously and effortlessly. But then just sitting there and having that aspiration, of course, that's not going to get you there. You know, just having the aspiration. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, well, and now what? And so there are two phases of it. And the second phase, which is almost like having a car where you've turned on the engine, but you haven't put it into gear yet. And then you put it into first gear, and now it starts to move. Same engine, it was already on, but now it's in motion. The second mode of bodhicitta is like that. It's engaged. And this is where, with that motivation, then you apply yourself to practicing vipassana, practicing the six perfections, cultivating virtue, purifying the mind. So now you're a bodhisattva in motion. You're on the bodhisattva path. What's the end point, the culmination of that path, is to become a Buddha. And a Buddha is simply one, in the Buddhist understanding, who is free of all obscurations, all afflictions of the mind irreversibly, and is completely drawn forth all the capacity of this Buddha nature, this pristine awareness or primordial consciousness. And so a bodhisattva is a Buddha to be, and a Buddha is one who's come to the culmination of the bodhisattva path. And then in the Mahayana view, now this is different from the Theravada. In the Mahayana view, once you become a Buddha, then you have a literally boundless capacity for manifesting in the world, taking on form in limitless ways. And here's where the prayer comes up. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, so long may I remain to alleviate the suffering of the world. And so the Mahayana view here is, once you've achieved perfect enlightenment, then you continue to manifest in the world until all sentient beings are free. But it's effortless. So I keep on emphasizing relaxation. It's brought to its perfection only then. Because it's said that when a Buddha manifests in the world, it's as effortless as the reflection of the moon appearing in a pool of water. How much effort did the moon have to give to appear, for its reflection to appear in one little pool? When you look at the pool, when you actually look in the pool and see the reflection, if it's a really good reflection, a very, very still image, very still pool, it'll look just like the moon. It might be indistinguishable from the appearance of the moon up in the sky, but it's now two. So you actually have two light sources, right? One's the moon in the sky, but now you have another light source here of the moon in the water. But of course, if you have another pool, and now you have two reflections, the moon didn't have to give any special effort to create in that second reflection, or 1,000, or 10,000, or 1,000,000, or 1,000,000,000. No more effort was needed. They arise spontaneously. And so it's said that, in the Mahayana view, that a Buddha's activities in the world are spontaneous and effortless, like the reflections of the moon and water. So the culmination of the path, Buddhahood, those who are on that path are bodhisattvas. And this is why I mentioned a couple of days ago that, according to many of the greatest scholars and contemplatives of the Indian and the Tibetan tradition, where this is so central, one of my teachers, for example, Geshe Rabten, said, when after I had received his whole life story and he was summarizing his view, his sense of what Buddhism was about, he said, from his perspective, he told me this almost 40 years ago, he said, from my perspective, speaking from this, within this Mahayana context, all of Buddha Dharma, all practices, fit into one of three categories. All of them. Either they are practices leading up to the realization of bodhicitta, or they are the actual cultivation and realization of bodhicitta, or they are outflows of bodhicitta. And there's nothing more to Buddha Dharma than that, of the Mahayana Buddha Dharma. There are many of the scholars, the greatest scholars of this Mahayana tradition, have stated that in order for this bodhicitta to arise so spontaneously, effortlessly, that it just comes like breathing, Ashantideva, one of the great bodhisattvas, says, when it arises like that, the bodhicitta is still there even when you take a nap or you're just kind of resting and, you know, like that. It's still there. It's still, the engine is on. And you're still actually moving towards enlightenment even when you're just taking a rest, okay? That's when it becomes uncontrived, spontaneous, and effortless. So, finally, to say this sentence, many of the greatest scholars and contemplatives of India and Tibet asserted that in order for bodhicitta to become so utterly spontaneous, first you have to develop and realize shamatha. The mind really has to be serviceable. It has to be supple. It has to be stable and clear. It has to be a suitable vessel in order to cultivate that, so that the bodhicitta can completely take root and then spring forth and arise spontaneously. That is, bodhicitta just doesn't thrive, it doesn't prosper, it doesn't flourish in the mind that's still oscillating between excitation, laxity, or is encumbered by what are called the five hindrances. And these are malice, sensual craving, lethargy and dullness, excitation and remorse, and then finally, what's the fifth one? Oh, debilitating skepticism, or just uncertainty, wavering uncertainty. Those are called the five obscurations. Insofar as the mind is still encumbered by those, this is like really thorny, rocky soil, and bodhicitta is just not going to grow well there. So the Buddha himself said, as long as the mind is encumbered by these five obscurations or hindrances, one feels like one is lost, one is in a trackless desert, one is ill, one is really, you know, how do you say, incapacitated. From the perspective of those who are free, to still have those five hindrances looks pretty awful. And shamatha is the out. Shamatha makes those five hindrances go dormant. Your mind now is serviceable, it's supple, it's stable, it's clear, it's ready, it's really ready for the big task at hand. So that's that, okay? So that's the difference between bodhisattva and Buddha. Clear? Okie dokie. And lo and behold, it's 6 o'clock. So enjoy your meal, and I'll see you tomorrow, 9 o'clock.